Welcome to the Wheel of Sport, home of the greatest sports stories ever told. My name's Ian McNally, and with me is...
It's Matt Lavery, Matt Lavery! Hello, listener. Hello, Ian.
Oh, yes. Let's get into it, Matt. Let's get that wheel spinning.
Off she goes.
Have you got any news, Matt?
Yeah, I got married. Jewellery update.
Again?
Again.
Oh, sorry, you're not supposed to mention that, yeah? forgot we were recording. And how is your first wife?
The current wife. Great. Really, really lots of fun.
Excellent. And the topic for this episode is...
It's out of bounds. Can we take this one off?
Out of bounds? Oh, Matt, this is one of those ones where I'm a bit conflicted because this topic, it kind of fits on a number of topics, and maybe out of bounds is the most appropriate because this is the story of how technology relates to sport. Now, as soon as I say that to you, can you just just come off the top of your head here, come in red hot. You could probably list 10, 20 technological advances that has a strong relationship with sport.
Of course.
You're just choosing not to. That's fine. That's fine.
Exactly. No, of course. But when you're saying technology, I mean, I guess athletics would be one, like with the shoes and things. All sorts. The ball in most sports has evolved, obviously, from... Yeah, there's technology everywhere in sport, right?
Matt, you're absolutely spot on. It's everywhere. But we're going to go on a bit of an adventure because, obviously... The sweet spot of this podcast is not the obvious. Obviously, there's things going on in sport and technologies. We'll comment on some of those, but I'm going to take you on a journey, the way that relationship... Sometimes the technology actually advances the sport, and sometimes it's the other way around, where if the sport didn't exist, the technology advancement wouldn't exist either. So it's a really nice relationship, yin and yang, but... Let's get started with some of the obvious ones, Matt. So, April 1921, that early, is the first ever live sports event broadcast ever in the world. It's a boxing match. Yeah, so can you imagine the first voice-recorded live boxing match? It's interesting that boxing was the choice.
Yeah, that's really surprising.
I suppose in some ways it's the simplest because it's either one fella punching the other fella or not, isn't it? It's just like very linear.
I suppose as well the arena that they fight in is, you know, the ring is smaller than a football pitch or a cricket pitch, you know.
Yeah, and you have the noise of the crowd close by amplified, and then also when you say, oh, the boxer is, like, this was between Johnny Dundee and good old Johnny Ray, referenced in Dexy's Midnight Runner song. If Johnny Ray's on the ropes, you can just say he's on the ropes. You don't need to say which ropes. You don't have to say north, south, east or west, do you? Yeah. It's very simple for a commentator to say, oh, he's just been punched in the head. Yeah. Whether he's lying on the floor or not, or he's got a cut above the eye or whatever, it seems quite linear and easy. So maybe that was the reason for it being the first choice. But as a result, because that's the first, it was KDKA in Pittsburgh who broadcast that in 1921. And obviously, it was great for that emerging technology of radio, of public radio. But as we said, the reciprocal relationship, it really boosts the popularity of boxing because everyone can tune into it and it's free. And so people then start learning who the boxers are. They show an interest in the sport. They think, oh, maybe one day if I want to get my head punched in, I could also be on the radio.
Yeah.
So, you know, you already from that one event, you're seeing a reciprocal agreement there between, or reciprocal arrangements between sport and technology. The next one is probably notable is in 1927, which was the first UK broadcast. So the BBC has recently been formed. And 1927, it was the England-Wales rugby game at Twickenham. And 2 weeks later, Arsenal and Sheffield United became the first ever football game broadcast on radio live. So quite a way behind, a good 6 years behind the very first one in the US. Obviously, radio takes off. It's a big thing. And the other thing to notice is that when the BBC takes off, the BBC has a world service.
Yeah.
And so it popularises sports that are in parts of the empire that had never been popular. And so there we see a growth and whether sports were certainly consolidated at the very minimum, but when they start broadcasting boxing, cricket, the football, rugby, these sports start to gain popularity in parts of the globe that they have no reason to be gaining popularity. So there's a massive knock on there. Let's jump on to TV while we're on here, because this is going to go all over the place, Matt. We're going to cover so much. Feel free to jump in with any caveats that you might know yourself. But the first ever Olympics that were broadcast live, can you guess what Olympics it would have been on TV? This is, forget radio, television.
No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't have a clue. Would it? Was it post-war? Was it or
no? It was very much Third Reich pre-war.
Right, Berlin. Okay.
It was the 1936 Berlin Olympic Games. Strangely enough, it was broadcast live in black and white, and it was only broadcast to the athletes in the Olympic Village, and to the public via 25 special viewing rooms located in Berlin and nearby Potsdam.
Isn't that lovely? You could go and watch it in like a sort of fan zone.
Yeah, exactly. It's the Nazi fan zones.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was the first time a sporting event had ever been seen live on television. And it kind of opened the floodgates, but it wasn't until Rome in 1960, which was the first Olympic Games to be broadcast live across Europe. There was television crews in Melbourne in 1956, but the potential to broadcast internationally live was very limited. And then in Tokyo 1964, that was the first worldwide reach television Olympic Games, but it wasn't in colour until 1968 in Mexico City.
Would you get the highlights? Like, would you get like news snippets in the news or clips or anything before then, or was that the first time it was broadcast full stop?
Yeah, no, absolutely. There'd be highlight packages sent and TV. It just wasn't live. So,
yeah, okay.
But we're still in a world where radio's dominant. People still want to listen live, but obviously, if it's taking place in Melbourne, Australia, there's a time difference anyway. So that probably limits people, tuning in live and things on the radio. But we're still in a very newspaper-dominated environment as well. We'll get onto that later because it does drive some very interesting technology in the newspaper world. The other notable things, I mean, does that feel late to you, 1968, for the first colour broadcast of the Olympic Games?
Yeah, I'd say it does feel late. It's difficult. I mean, like, it does feel late to me, yeah. But then I don't know. Maybe it obviously isn't.
Yeah, like, don't get me wrong, there is colour footage of earlier games, but just not the capacity to do that live. So sport really is kind of helping drive this emergent technology. But no more so, Matt, than in the UK, because the BBC were the first ever broadcasting company to buy colour cameras, and they bought two colour TV cameras. They're the first in the world. Nobody had a colour television. So they had the capacity to broadcast in colour, but of course nobody watched in colour TV.
That's great.
Yeah, isn't it amazing? It provided a huge dilemma, though, because they launched BBC Two in the 1960s. They switched to colour in just after the kind of, I think it was 1967 or so, they switched to colour, broadcasting in colour. But the vast majority of people in the UK at that time still had a black and white television. Mm-hmm. How do you get them to buy colour television? You broadcast something that needs colour and is also vivid and beautiful and bright, and you can turn a dial to check that the colours on your television are working correctly.
Right.
Snooker, Matt. Snooker.
Of course. That's brilliant. That is brilliant. I think for a long time they used to... The FA, so the Football Association in England, wouldn't have like a red team and a blue team, both with dark shorts on. One of them would have to wear like lighter shorts so that you could see, even in black and white, that they weren't the same team, you know?
What was more important was contrast and not colour.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so you'd have stripes or something. But yeah, of course, with the snooker, that's great.
Yeah, so the snooker was shown as part of a TV show which was devised by BBC Two, which was an emergent channel called Pot Black. And Pot Black was 8 professional snooker players playing off against each other to see who would be the overall winner. I think it was Ray Reardon who actually won the initial series. But the thing is, Matt, what this did is that it gave an excuse for people to buy a colour television, because you don't necessarily have the same contrast in snooker with some of the balls. For example, the red and the brown, it's very difficult to differentiate on a black and white TV.
Yeah.
And you can imagine in households they were saying, oh, come on, can we buy a colour TV because I love watching a snooker. I can't really get into it. And also that technical thing of being able to have the ball set up and you know where the yellow is supposed to be, the brown, the green, the blue, the pink, the reds, the black.
Yeah.
And then you can adjust your TV set in tune with the snooker table, which is
so funny.
Just brilliant. Do you know who pushed this idea at the BBC?
Go on.
This is amazing, Matt. BBC Two, the person who pushed through getting this Pot Black snooker TV show on BBC Two was David Attenborough.
I felt like you were going to say that because I knew that he was the boss
controller.
Back then, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And I was like, is he going to say Attenborough? I wish I'd just gone for it.
Yeah, and isn't it great that Attenborough would be
That's
the perfect
amazing.
Commentator?
Oh,
you know,
so good.
Here we see behind... The brown ball in its natural habitat. You know, it's just perfect, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So,
brilliant.
Look, it runs on from there. So that is a massive shift in British television history, driven by snooker. Not given the whole credibility, I think, and not talked about enough. That's why this podcast exists, Matt. another emergent technology, which had hardly been used, which was very, very difficult to use, was because the sport of darts had came back into popularity in the 1970s. But the problem was broadcasting it was the people sat in a truck, in the OB truck, the outside broadcast, mm-hmm. getting the feed from the cameras in the pub, no, let's be kind, in the theatre, in the auditorium, getting the feed, they would be wearing out the buttons on the desk because they were constantly flicking between the board and the player because they wanted to get where the darts were going, but also the player's emotion.
Yeah.
And it was just too hard. And so they used this relatively unused technology, which was the split screen. And the split screen had hardly been used before in television at all, because it just had no use until the game of darts came along. And then it was on all of the time, you know, darts. See the player throwing, you can see the, his face, see the emotion, and yet you can still see the darts going in on the board. Even to this day, they still have some challenges in where to zoom in on the dartboard, on where the player is moving around, so on, because particularly when a player is checking out in darts, which is a bad thing in general life when people check out, but a good thing in darts. So when they're checking out and they need, you know, double tops to finish, the zoom into double tops, but obviously a player could end up somewhere else on a dartboard. So that some of that technology is now automated and computers have been trained to do that zooming in and zooming out. But quite amazing how it, something so simple as a split screen really came to prominence because of that in the 1970s.
That's great.
And again, yeah, again, it kind of drives the technology, but also drives the sport, because as soon as you've got the split screen, so much more enjoyable to watch, so much more informed is the viewer. A few other things, Matt, regarding kind of broadcast stuff, and then we'll move on to some other things. When would you say, like, umpires or referees were mic'd up in a game?
Oh, well, I mean, depends on the sport. There's that famous incident where they mic'd up a referee. Was it David Ellery in the Arsenal
David
game?
Ellery, yeah.
Yeah, and Martin Keown. The players just cursed it. It was Arsenal Millwall, wasn't it? And they just cursed out the referee. And they decided, we're not going to do that anymore. Rather than discipline the players for swearing, they just took the microphone away. It was too foul mouthed.
Was David Ellery, he was a school teacher, I think, wasn't he? And he was very school teacherish. And I think Tony Adams at one point called him a cheat. And that was like where he drew the line. I would not be called a cheat.
So good.
You can call me a fucking dickhead, but not a cheat.
Well, that's why there's no mic referees even to this day in soccer or football. But like a lot of other sports would have had mic'd up referees, I guess, for quite a while. It's great in the rugby. You know, it's really informative when they're doing the TVR or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. So in the NFL and gridiron in the US, wireless mics on officials have been used since 1975.
Wow.
Amazingly, the umpires in Major League Baseball had been mic'd up using a special device since 1929. They started that.
Wow.
1929, they had a mic that went to the PA system in the stadium so that they could call a ball or a strike.
That's great.
And you know what's great about it as well? One of the newspapers coined it the umplifier.
Very good.
It's that sweet. The other thing just on television and broadcast is slow motion. So again, hardly used in television, really, until you get to sport. It was first used in November 1961. There was a football game broadcast by the ABC in the US, Boston College. That was the first widespread use of slow motion. But again, that ability to be able to slow the footage down so you can really see what's going on. Or the other bit of technology is action replay. So to be able to edit that piece of footage and deliver it back to the viewer in real time so they can see that goal again or see that incident again is something very much we take for granted now.
Yeah, and of course.
You know, like you can go on YouTube now, I did it at the weekend just looking at one of Liverpool's goals, and they showed it literally from about 14 angles. It's like a 3-minute clip of the same goal. Mm-hmm. 14 different angles. But we take that very much for granted, I think, that now. But slow motion was a huge, and action replay was a huge benefit to the viewer. But it's, again, sport that demands that technology and that drive, which is quite extraordinary. So moving away from that kind of broadcast tech, I can't believe how excited I'm getting about this map, by the way.
I know.
I'm so into it.
Anytime you can give credit to snooker and darts, though. Anything. yeah. Whatever. That's because of the snooker, isn't it?
Absolutely fair criticism, but I feel I'm absolutely justified. Actually, I was going to say I'm moving on from broadcast. I just want to note about football, soccer ball in the UK when it was broadcast, that they actually used to print in the newspapers a grid of this field. And when they were talking about it on radio in the early days, they would actually reference what grid reference the players were at or the ball was. So they'd like say, oh, the ball's moved from C1 and now, oh, long ball now into G4, whatever, you know.
That's crazy. I've never heard of that before. It's totally not, it's totally unnecessary as well.
Yeah, but you can understand why people chose it, because they were thinking, well, how can people visualise where the ball is on the field? And is it necessary?
I mean, these days they would just say advancing into their half on their left wing or whatever.
Yeah, and I think that's where the grid system got like debunked, because it was like, well, you know, people are more imaginative than we thought.
Yeah. I've never heard of that. That's amazing.
On that note, Matt, as well, I just want to give a quick mention to chess, the game of chess, which has appeared on this podcast before, Deep Blue. But one of the technologies that a lot of chess fans used for many years was Royal Mail. Because have you heard of this, that people used to play postal chess?
Never heard of it.
So they'd set up their board and then move, and they'd mail their one move, put it in the post, send it to somebody they were playing across the country, and then they'd get that move the person, write down the coordinates of their move, like knight to A3.
That's brilliant.
Send it back in the post. It'd take years to complete. But
yeah, you'd do a move every 5 to 5 days or something for a week.
That's
absolutely fantastic.
I'm not sure why I mentioned that, because I'm not sure it drives any technology, but fun anyway.
A lot of fun.
Couple of things as well about... Let's move into the modern era, because there's a couple of things here which I found fascinating, which is one of them is the influence on software video games. So video games, you think on the face of it, are just a bit of fun. People playing the particularly like EA Sports, Championship Manager, FIFA. And on the face of it, they run alongside the sport. They're not integral to the sport. But Championship Manager, this might be my personal opinion, I think it has changed a huge way in the way players are scouted.
100%.
Yeah, because previously when you scout a player, like, what's your understanding of how players were scouted in like the 1980s?
Well, yeah, as I understand it, some guy would just make a judgment call and say, yeah, he's good or he's not, and then that would be enough. But now, yeah, I know a bit about this with Football Manager as it is now, or Championship Manager as it sort of was then, in the 90s. They've got the largest scouting network on earth. And so football clubs now, so the database we would buy as consumers is one size. But you know, if you're a professional, you can buy access to a much bigger database and do your scouting through there. Like, basically every single football club, every professional football club on earth now uses the Football Manager and Championship Manager database, which is just incredible, because they've got a bigger scouting network than anybody else. It's a resource. It's absolutely crazy, yeah. And it's a game.
Yeah, and it kind of goes to show you, like, some bloke in his underpants just playing Champ Man for 14 hours a day is driving a whole international sport. He's helping input into that.
That would be me. I absolutely love that game. I've lost a lot of days of my life.
Yeah, I had to stop myself playing it at university. I was like, after first year of university, I was like, I've cannot play that anymore and haven't returned to it since. But the other one, Matt, is FIFA. So FIFA, which became more and more realistic and then really took off with like the PlayStation and Xbox and so on. Now, there's some evidence to suggest that the players who are emerging now have grown up playing with FIFA, and some of the skills that existed in FIFA when they were kids didn't actually exist in the real world. So nobody had done those skills in a real game. And then in FIFA, they had obviously the latitude of it being fictional. So there were some skills that they could do that didn't exist. And in turn, some of those skills you can now see in the modern game.
Have you got an example?
No. But there's, so it's probably anecdotal evidence at this stage, but there's certainly a notion around that says that some of the different techniques and the different skills and things that you can do that players are doing now have originated from playing FIFA.
Wow.
So I'd love to see more research on that and see whether there's some more you know, proof on that. But I kind of love that idea that, again, a computer game is really affecting real life in this way and the technology.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. I remember playing as a kid, and we used to joke about, like, you drag the ball over to the right-hand side, and you would all shout, like, R2, as if, like, that, because that was the button you had to push to, like, knock the ball to the right and shimmy over. But it was it's just so silly.
Like, there's loads of technology in terms of clothing and shoes and all of that extra, even, like, things like we've discussed before about the history of the bicycle and Chris Boardman as well with the Lotus bike in 1992, carbon fibre bike. So there's those kind of more obvious technologies. Some of the more niche ones are things like driving the quality of televisions. So, like, the size of televisions, they tell you in the shop, Matt, that it's for watching movies, it's for watching sports. There was actually a big problem with some of the early plasma and LCD TVs, where when you're watching soccer or something where the ball moves quickly, you got like a lag. So it had like a trail on the ball and things like that, where they really had to solve this problem, again, not because of movies or anything else, because of specific sports and how they appeared on television. Even technologies like building indestructible TVs and protective shells around TVs so they can put them in stadiums and pubs, because they know when people get emotional, they might throw glassware at that television and they want it to bounce off and not destroy the television. Couple of interesting ones as well, like in terms of like red button technology or player cams, you know, the notion that they follow just one player around. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm going to draw a long bow here, Matt. They've done this in movies, you know, where they've just had, it's called like a bubble effect, where you just follow one character for the whole movie and nobody else is in it. Mm-hmm. The first ever soap opera in the UK to adopt this for a whole episode.
Go on.
It was Brookside. And they followed one character in a bubble. And I can't help thinking that Brookside has massively influenced that move for player cam.
Do people actually use that stuff, though? I always think it's just so, like, gimmicky. Like, who actually wants to just watch a player walking? They're not actually doing anything for most of the game. The game, the action is where the ball is. Follow the ball. Don't follow the player.
It is very gimmicky. Like, I just don't know what you get out of, as you say, like, a player's just walking around. Generally, particularly if it's a soccer player, they generally walk around spitting.
Yeah. Yeah, that's about right.
And if I want to see that, I'll just go outside the local high school and watch teenage boys do that, sit on walls and spit. It seems to be the recreation of our time. A few of the other things that you know are affected, I'll just briefly mention. Think about like the World Cups and the Olympics. Certainly the upcoming World Cup in the Middle East could never be broadcast if it wasn't for that advance in technology. Same with South Africa and South America and so on, having that vivid imagery and the ability to broadcast around the world syndicated. That is mostly driven by sport and investments in the technology there. There's a few things I'll give a quick mention to. We could do a whole episode on how sporting architecture and things that influence. The same with things like technology around surfaces for tennis, which are both driven by the quality of the surface, whether it's clay or whether it's lawn or plastic, but also driven by making your tournament iconic and easily recognizable. For example, the Australian Open, they used to have a green court and they moved to this iconic blue color because it was much more saleable to a tennis audience. But the technology involved in that obviously is significant. The one I want to end on, Matt, is one from my childhood, which we said about newspapers before, but this, I don't know, you might have had an equivalent in the Northeast. But in Liverpool, on a Saturday afternoon, all the games would kick off around the country for soccer, Football Association. They'd all kick off at 3. The games would finish about 4:45. And by 4:45, you'd have a newspaper in your hand, which had been freshly printed.
Yeah, the pink.
In that hour from kickoff, the pink. Yeah, and there was a Pink Echo in Liverpool. Was it? It was the Sporting or the Sports Argus in the Midlands, I think, in Birmingham.
Yeah, I think it was the Football Journal in the Northeast.
Football Journal.
I think that's what it was called.
And these newspapers generally had all of the local sports news from in the week that was kind of pre-written or from the amateur leagues and stuff from the previous weekends. But crucially, it would have all the updated league tables and the results and the local games all written up, just literally hot off the press. Yeah. I remember going to a train station in Liverpool, like on the way home, a big blue van would turn up full of Pink Echoes and everyone would get one. They'd sell out. People would be standing outside newsagents waiting for them. Obviously, this is pre-internet, pre-Twitter. You know, and the joy of this collective thing and also the technology, like, again, sport driving this social phenomena and the technology and the knock-on effect of, like, if a game, say a pitch is invaded and the game's 15 minutes late, how that affects all the printing presses, the people working them, the people in the vans, how full the chip shops are. It's everything gets knocked on from this amazing technology, which was killed. This technology was killed essentially by the lack of 3 p.m. kickoffs and the moving and the shift away, and then obviously the internet popularity and people getting their news elsewhere other than newspapers. But the sporting pinks, I mean, quite a highlight. I don't know how long they were around. They're certainly, I know in Liverpool, they were around from about the 60s, I think it was, and the 70s. So, and obviously it died out by about 2005.
I remember we used to get one after the match. We'd drive back and pick one up when we got the, as you say, the fish and chips or the takeaway or whatever. Pop into the newsagents and grab the pink. It was great.
Yeah, I was actually in the Liverpool Echo pink football echo once because I scored in the amateur league. My only goal I've ever scored in a proper game. Yeah. And it got in the echo, so 4-4 against top of the... We were second from bottom, Wood Street, and we drew against the Mariners, who had won every game by quite a way, and we drew 4-4 at their home ground.
Hey, that's an episode in itself, isn't it?
Oh, mate, 4-4. Incredible. Matt, we haven't even talked about Hawkeye, Opta.
Formula One.
Formula One. I mean, there's so much to cover in this, but I hope that we've given some obscure moments in technology a bit of a go. I feel like I've got a huge list in front of me, which I just came up on off the top of my head. But I just love it. We haven't even talked about how floodlights, technology around that, drones, the way they film. Yeah. It's just so endless. But I just love this. Generally, this episode was more about the notion and the awareness. Like, next time you're watching sport, just to give a bit of thought about the amount of other industries it supports and the other technologies it drives is quite incredible to me.
Yeah, absolutely. I love it, Ian. Thank you so much. What a great, I don't know if it's a story, great conversation. It's a lot of fun. And thank you, listener, for tuning in again. You can go back through Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts and listen to all of our rich episodes, so many now. If you've got a suggestion for an episode, do get in touch. You can reach us at The Wheel of Sport on Twitter, or you can email us at thewheelofsport@gmail.com. Thank you so much. Give us a review as well if you get a chance. Now Ian's always pushing for reviews.
Yeah, thanks. 5 stars only. And Matt, I'm off to see if I can think up other ways to get in the Liverpool Echo.
Yeah. Good luck.
I feel like my football career's over, so I've got to find increasingly nefarious ways to get in the local newspaper. Thanks, Matt.
Cheers. That was a lot of fun.